Nordic Sustainable Economy Podcast Series, delivered by Nordic Council of Ministers.
Hello and welcome to the Nordic Talks at the podcast of Aribev. Today's program is called Migration and Mobility, Living Next Door to the Nordics. Our guests today are esteemed researchers from Estonia and Finland, the director of the Migration Institute of Finland, Professor Sara Belander, dean of Faculty of Social Sciences, Professor Raul Jamets from the University of Tartu, member of Estonian Academy of Sciences, Professor Tiit Tammaru, also from the University of Tartu, and my name is Madis Kanarbik. I work at the Nordic Council of Ministers office in Estonia, branch office in Tartu. When we talk about migration, one can often notice that it's very much referred as a problem. And my first question to you, Sara, is how do you think is migration a problem to be solved or maybe more a possibility to be used? And what are the main reasons for migration? Why do people leave their home country?
Yes, thank you. And thanks for inviting me to this talk. It's nice to be here and discuss this with you. Well, I guess we all know that in public discussions over migration, it tends to be treated as a problem quite often. What actually is interesting, if we look at kind of the history of migration and also of humankind, then actually migrating is the norm and staying where you are is actually the exception, and that people are sedentary and don't migrate at all is actually something rather exceptional if we look at it from a historical perspective. But personally, I, and also when we look at research results on this topic, it clearly is a possibility and not a problem. I guess that migration is made a problem in these public discussions. But then what is often raised in these discussions are actually problems that are actually rarely caused by migration itself, but that are problems that do exist in societies anyway. And then if we look at some negative effects that migration might have, then often the causes of them are also not actually migration itself, but then certain policies and structures in society that, for example, exclude or discriminate certain groups of people. Or if we look at the worst results and effects, the fact that thousands of people are drowning, for example, in the Mediterranean on their ways to Europe. So here, the migration itself is not the problem, but, for example, the fact that some people cannot just book a ticket and get on a plane to move from one country to another, and they have to risk their lives. So I would argue that it's certain migratory systems that make migration difficult or that treat people differently because, for example, of their country of origin, that is more of a problem and not migration itself. And then another important point here is that this problem talk is tied to certain types of migration. So, for example, we don't very often hear the fact that Finns who move to Spain and who live in their own Finnish communities and that they don't integrate properly into Spanish society. That's, for example, something that's not talked about very much, but then offer certain kind of professions. For example, if highly skilled migrants or an IT expert lives in the country for years and doesn't speak the local language, that is not seen as a problem. But then for other groups, if they don't speak the language or live in their own communities, that is treated as a problem. So it's not that migration itself is treated as a problem, but certain people are treated differently.
Yes, thank you, Sara. There are really huge numbers who are involved in international migration. And according to the United Nations, it's about 280 million people involved over the whole world, which is about 3.5% of the global population. Tiit, would you like to add a few remarks on that topic?
Yes, you're right that the number of migrants is growing. Also, their share is growing somewhat in the total world population, but that growth has maybe not been that big. So it's been something like 3 to 3.5%. But as Sara already explained, really migration is really something that is a very complex term, and then there are very different views on this as well. And maybe I will point out some of them. When you talk about migration as a problem, then sometimes it's seen as a problem from the sending or leaving country perspective, because they feel the population is shrinking, and more specifically the talented people are those who leave. When it comes to the receiving countries, then there are also several problems. For example, some people have the perception that migrants take away certain jobs, or due to their arrival at the labor market, the wages don't grow as quickly. And also there are sometimes issues with the integration of the migrants. So there are issues are really complex there. But usually when we take the migrant's own perspective, then usually migration means that the life improves. But also for migrants themselves, certain problems might be an issue. We know that, so to say, adaptation stress is related to migration and so on. So migration has many opportunities, but certainly these kind of problems that relate to migration from different perspectives have to be understood. And maybe the final remark I would like to make, and also related to Sara's previous discussion, is that the phenomenon of migration itself has changed. I mean, a century ago, people went maybe with horses, traveled several months over the land or sea, and then settled, and then maybe even assimilated finally over the generations. Today, it's a completely different phenomenon. People are moving around much more for different reasons. So the permanent component in migration has certainly become less relevant than, let's say, a century or even half a century ago.
Yeah, thank you. That's really very interesting, this change in migration. But as there are these huge numbers involved, then certainly countries are trying to somehow influence migration through political tools and migration policies. Raul, would you like to say a few words about these political instruments to influence migration?
Thank you. First of all, as already was mentioned here, that we have different types of migrants and different categories of migration, and there is a huge number of typologies how to categorize them. I usually use a very simple one in my lectures. I separate my migrant into three broad categories: economic migrants, who mostly go to the other country in order to work and earn income, and then social migrants, who go to the other country in order to get cheap life or better environment conditions. It's exactly the Finns in Spain example. And then you have a political refugees or political migrants who are the categories which is what exactly happened in 2015 when we had a refugee crisis in EU. So mostly political refugees from third nations. But if we go to the policy, migration policy issue, then usually the other typology is used, and the most regulated migration flow is work migration, people who go to work to another country. And this is a place where usually countries introduce different restrictions, quotas, qualitative, quantitative restrictions. And then you have family migration, which is not so much regulated in this sense or restricted, that this is a human right to bring your family members with you to the other country, where you have a policy options is how big the family circle is or who are the family members, but this is treated as a human right. And then you have a third category of migrants, a student migration. And this is usually where people encourage people to move, not to restrict them. So if we talk about student migration, it is treated as a education export, and most countries look student migrant as a future talents and the future high skill labor. And of course, this is very beneficial for destination country economy.
Can I jump in here quickly?
Yes, of course, Sara. I know that you have researched migration policies. Would you like to add something here?
I would like to maybe add that I would not agree that, I mean, of course, family migration is luckily and should also be based on this human rights approach that people have a right to family life. But I've studied family reunification. I wrote my doctoral dissertation about it. So I would kind of disagree that this is not as strongly regulated as, for example, labor migration, because there are a lot of many regulations also related to bringing your family or moving with your family or following a family member. And many European countries, for example, recently have in the past 10, 20 years restricted these policies even more. And the kind of requirements are becoming stricter. And we find also many cases where people who are biologically and by all means considered to be a family can still not move and be with each other. So even though, I mean, in some cases, immigration authorities, for example, doubt if these are real family ties or are they actually related to each other or what are the motives for getting married, these kind of issues. But actually also in cases where it's clear that this is a family and it is acceptable family life also in the view of immigration authorities, there might be restrictions that still make it impossible to actually reunite and live together. So actually, I would disagree that this is a category that is not regulated very much. It actually is.
Yeah, if I make perhaps my sources were not very clear, I didn't say that they are not regulated, but that is much harder to restrict reunification as it is a human right. And as you said correctly, there is a lot of cases where people are just cheating. And as I said, where you can strongly regulate is who is your family member. And you can have a broad meaning of family and you have very narrow meaning of family. And of course, countries have a right to regulate this.
But Sara, would you like to add a few remarks on the migration policies in different Nordic countries? Is there something that differs from one country to another, maybe?
Well, I have not comprehensively compared all Nordic countries' immigration policies, and also, of course, they are changing all the time, depending on which government is in force where. So I think overall, at least from the Finnish perspective, one can often find that other Nordic countries are used as examples or as points of reference or comparisons. So often when new bills are introduced, for example, to the parliament, there's the discussions about these often tends to...
Thank you very much, Sara. Then migration policies are often related to the question of issue of integration of migrants. Maybe, Diet, you could say a few words about the integration of the newcomers to the receiving countries. How are they integrated?
Yeah, I think that's one of the crucial issues, that how the migration processes and integration processes are related. And of course, if we look at the studies, the relationship is highly, highly complex. When we talk about the relationship first, I think what countries try to do is they try to limit somehow the annual flows. Because one thing what we also saw from the European refugee crisis a few years ago is that if the volumes get very high, the problems of integration and also resistance from the host societies starts to grow as well. So probably that's the starting point for many countries. And in Estonia as well, but in many other countries, we have the annual quotas on migration, and that restricts how many people can arrive. But also then there are different views how to link migration and integration. For example, there is lots of focus on the labor market issues and how labor market participation and migration could be linked. But we have studied... also migration in the Nordics and Finland and especially in Sweden. And what we interestingly see is that actually for many migrants, when they arrive to Sweden, for example, there is no job waiting because there are different categories of migrants actually arriving. And so the integration processes actually start and should start from where people settle, so that the city level and neighborhood level measures are really important, and if things go swiftly there, also the host country perception would not be that problematic. But if we see lots of problems there, then this negative attitude can grow in society. So yeah, the types of migration is very much related to integration. And maybe it's a misconception that the labor market is a central, the place where migrants settle is actually the central issue.
Yes, well, labor migration has been mentioned several times, and as the United Nations report from 2019 says, then about two-thirds of global migration is connected to labor migration. So I would like to ask you, Raul, can we describe the influence of mobility and migration on economy and more broadly on the society?
But may I say a few words before that?
Of course.
About labor, about some migration policy issues in Estonia. In addition, what Tiit mentioned, that in my view, our migration policy is very passive. Passive in this sense that we don't target in any way our migration flows. Estonia has, as Tiit mentioned, quotas, which are pretty low, 0.1% of population, which makes 1,300 person per year. And then you have a large number of exceptions, like people who are working in IT sector, they don't have any quotas. Then you have investors. Then you have, of course, no quotas, no limits for people from US and from Canada, for example. And I think it's time to realize in Estonia as well that we have to be active. We have to be kind of sorting those people who are coming to Estonia. And usually you have two different types of migration policies. One is kind of employer-led recruitment system, when employer will tell what kind of labor is needed in what industry, in what branches. And then you have a kind of skill-based system, often called so-called point system, which is based on individual characteristics of immigrants rather than the availability of job offers. So we were investigating these different migration policies in not only in Scandinavia, but also some other countries like Canada and Australia and New Zealand, where they are using actively this point system. And our proposal coming out of our research project was that Estonia should also introduce certain point system-based migration policy, where we select based on individual characteristics what kind of people we would like to enter to Estonia. And this goes particularly for those who are high-skilled workers, so-called white-collar workers. And for a low-skilled workers, we were thinking about this employer-led recruitment system with some limits, as what often countries are using, like requirement for minimum wages, for instance. And and in Estonian case, we call it labor market test, where we will research whether domestic labor is available in this particular occupations or not, for instance. So I think that is, with this point system, I want to stress one thing. In Denmark, they tried to introduce, they used quite a few years the point-based migration policy, but that was one big shortcoming. They didn't ask those who came through this point system to Denmark job, that they, there was not job waiting for them. And what happened, that we saw many taxi drivers in Copenhagen with PhD degree, so they fulfilled all the categories, they got kind of green light to enter the country, and then they didn't found the job appropriate to the educational level. So in this sense, it is time to change migration policy, at least in Estonia, as we are now destination country. And I think in the future the same problems will appear in Latvia and Lithuania as well, because they will become the destination countries as well.
Yes.
Can I comment on this?
Of course. Please, Sara.
Yes. I wasn't finished before when I talked about these immigration policies in the Nordic countries. So what I started saying was that they take kind of an example from each other, but it's also in a way this kind of race to the bottom in many categories. It seems to be like who can make the most restrictive immigration policies in many questions. And what I find problematic about that is that in times where everyone recognizes, just as we pointed out in the discussion here, that there's a need for, I mean, that the changing demographics in many countries is one that actually, that there's a need for people moving to these countries. And that at the same time, while we recognize that need, we make immigration policies stricter and stricter. And this is the development that has been going on for quite a while, and not only recently after the so-called refugee crisis, when, of course, there were many restrictions implemented after that, but this has been an ongoing trend for a longer time. And that actually, at the same time, while people are discussing that we need to somehow attract people and try to make them come here, we're making it much more difficult for people to arrive. Another central question is also, I find, and this links to the point about the taxi drivers with a PhD, that one question is people moving to the countries, but another is, what about the labor force that already is in the country? And there we find, and I think that's also a very general phenomenon, not only in Finland, that, for example, people who come here as students from another country and they have a degree that they make in Finland, they have a Finnish degree from a Finnish university and still have difficulties finding employment. And many people who already live here and have university backgrounds and all that it's really difficult for them to enter the job market or find jobs that are on the level of their knowledge. And the Nordic countries, including Finland, have one of the largest employment gaps between native-born and migrants from the outside EU. And I think this is a big problem that we need to tackle. And this links to integration, because often when we talk about integration, we talk about, well, which group has integrated how well. And in recent integration scholarship, what is being talked about very much is that instead of focusing only on the incoming groups, we need to focus on the societies. And how do they adapt and how can they change and how can they accommodate people better? And the talk there is about two-way integration, or oftentimes one even speaks about three-way integration, including also the country where people have left from. So I think this is a very central issue that we have to look at, how we can make these societies more inclusive and so that people can find opportunities to work, but also to live a fulfilling life. So one last short point about this is that when we talk about integration, we often stop where we discuss employment and then don't look at other parts of life. I mean, if people find a job, that's one thing, but they won't stay in the country if they don't feel at home, if they don't have social networks and friends, and if they don't feel that they have arrived also in many other areas of life. And there we also have this problem that people might arrive and work for a while and then leave again because they don't settle permanently. So I think also to think of integration as something that affects all society, not only incoming migrants, that all society has to change and become more welcoming in many ways, but then also that it doesn't stop at finding a job.
Yeah, thank you. Thank you, Sara. These are all very important aspects of migration. I see that Diet, you would like to add also something here.
Yeah, these are really interesting discussions that Sara took up. The thing, what is the relationship between demographics and labor market and what kind of skills we are waiting for and also the host country attitude. And of course, maybe with the scholars, we think of some ideal ways how to handle, but we also have to understand that people and societies are quite diverse in their opinions. And of course, labor market is aging in Europe, and so there is this need for labor. But what's maybe more broad and interesting trend that this aging is not a Europe-specific phenomenon. I mean, all the societies across the globe, maybe only sub-Saharan Africa is an exception, all are aging. So this vision how to accommodate labor market changes without migration is something that we have to vision as well in the 50-year perspective. And then, of course, the other issue is the skills of the people. And we know that countries really compete more and more with each other for the skills. And so has been Estonia, but Europe at large as well, also having these different visa regimes, making it easier for people with certain skills to move and so on. So that's another issue. And of course, the relationship between integration and migration is complex, but it seems to me that even if we want that societies are more willing to accept migrants, we can't force to force societies. And there, I think the swift integration process is really, really important, because the perceived threat, is it grounded or ungrounded? We can debate about it, and certainly people have different opinions, but certainly we also have people who have this fear and towards migration, and the effects, possibly negative effects of migration are there. So we can't ignore also these and only talk about the positive narrative related to migration.
Yes, and Raul, please.
I think that's a very good point where we can talk about this, some economic effects of the migrants. As dominantly, if we look at the newspapers, we talk about the negative things mostly, that migrants are ready to work with a lower salary, with a long working hours. There is social dumping and hidden labor market among the migrant labor force. And these kind of negative effects are kind of dominating if you talk about economic effects. But if you look from the other side of the coin, of course, all migrants who come to work and come to live to destination country, they increase domestic demand. They also buy things, they also consume services and goods, they pay taxes, they will increase opportunities for consumers. In all large cities in Europe, you can find Chinese restaurants or Turkish kebab places. They create new jobs, they are more entrepreneurial as domestic usually. Of course, there are kind of so and so aspects, like so-called 3D jobs, dirty, dangerous and difficult jobs, what local people are reluctant to do, so migrants often do these jobs. So basically, it's not always only negative things, and there is a positive side as well. So question is that how concentrated the migration population or communities are. If we manage to spread the new migrants all over the country, then usually no problems appear. They will integrate smoothly to the population. But the problem is that they don't want to go to the countryside or the village 100 or 1,000 kilometers away from capital, and they will concentrate to the capital cities or around the capital cities. And then they will not find appropriate jobs. It's difficult to enter the education system because of language problems. And then you can see this increasing criminality and all these things what we can hear and see from the TV and the newspapers. So in this sense, And it has been problem, perhaps, Tiit, you want to add something, but the segregation has increased during the last 20 years, which means the concentration of different ethnic or language groups is even worse compared with the Soviet time.
Yeah, that's true. That's in Estonia. But if we look at Nordic countries or to European countries as well, this issue of spatial concentration, I think that is really an important topic to discuss. And very often we think that maybe migrants don't make that much of a share of the total population. But when they concentrate to certain cities and within the cities to certain neighborhoods, then the city starts to change. And what we have been studying recently a lot is this interconnectedness of segregation also in different like life domains, like at workplaces, at residential neighborhoods, and at schools. And the results are quite interesting. I already mentioned that very often migrants actually don't have a job. So I don't know from these global statistics come that 2/3 of migrants are labor migrants. That's certainly not true in the European, Nordic and Estonian context. There are other types of migrants who are in vast majority, actually. And when we look at the segregation levels in these different like life domains, work, residential neighborhoods and schools, then it differs. Labor market actually is usually even the least segregated, even despite the fact that migrants tend to take over certain jobs on the labor market. But still, the labor market is very much an individual skill-based thing, and there is a lot of diversity there. But the housing markets are already much more segregated because on the housing market, the resources of couples get combined. And usually, families form on the principle of homophily, meaning that usually better educated people are married with better educated, lower educated with lower educated. There is very little inter-ethnic marriages. So the individual resources combine on the housing market. And when low-skilled and high-skilled people form families, segregation on the housing market increases a lot because families themselves have financial resources, but also the credibility in the eyes of banks differ. So segregation at the housing market gets reinforced compared to the labor market. And since well-educated parents also have more stronger visions what the education of the kids should be, and since the schools have certain catchment areas around the residential neighborhoods, and since migrants tend to be young and in the family ages, then school segregation increases even more quickly than residential segregation. For example, if we take Helsinki, I mean, the share of migrants in Helsinki is not that big at all, but migrants concentrate to certain neighborhoods in Helsinki and also in certain schools. And in these schools, already migrants could be in a majority, and then all sorts of processes start. So, I mean, this kind of accumulation of segregation over different domains because of this spatial concentration, I mean, that's something that we had to think more carefully. Also, when we designed these integration policies that we thought before or discussed before as well.
Yes, now that we have discussed the positive and negative sides of migration, then it probably also is reflected in the public debate, in media and more broadly. So, Sara, would you maybe like to say a few words on how is migration and mobility over borders discussed in the Nordics, in also maybe Nordic-Baltic region more broadly?
One comment maybe to what we just discussed before, because when we talked about these economic effects of of migration, so I think what's also important to look at is kind of studies that have been done, like long-term studies, how does it actually affect the economy? And I think this links to also the question on the public discussion, because the points that were raised, like how migration affects wages or public spending, these kind of things are those that are often raised in public debates. But actually, when you look at research on long-term effects of migration, you find that, there's a long-term study looking at OECD countries for the what the effect of migration is for the past 50 years, that actually says that it's close to zero, actually. So that it's so the impact was actually higher in Switzerland, Luxembourg, where the benefit was 2% of the GDP, and the others, it was actually almost nothing. So basically saying that immigration doesn't cost the economy much, but it also doesn't benefit it much in the long term. But then there's also a lot of studies saying how it contributes to the economy exactly by the points that were just pointed out by kind of also being consumers of goods and buying things and all that. So actually, I think that's also important to notice that when we discuss effects of migration, it's rarely based on long-term studies on how does it actually affect the economy, but oftentimes on kind of populist decision-making, kind of populist kind of public debates where you say, oh, look what this costs for the taxpayer, or these kind of arguments which actually don't really look at what the economic effects are.
Thank you, Sara. Well, this is really interesting. I see that Raul wants to add something here also.
Yes, I didn't want to go into details, but the interesting fact is if you look at these economic studies, indeed, in Europe, they found zero effect. In US, if you look Boreas and the other authors, they found a slight negative effect. So it's the European situation is slightly different compared to the US situation. And only explanation I can say is perhaps effects of unions, which is much stronger in European Union countries.
But how does, yes?
To come back to the question that you posed about the public discussion, I didn't get back to that
yet.
Yeah,
thank you, Sarah.
One thing in general about public debates about migration, and I talk about that quite a lot, is that it focuses very much on humanitarian migration, refugees, asylum seekers, which of course are really important topics and is something that can and should be discussed, but it is over proportional to the actual amount of people that come, for example, to Europe to seek asylum. And even though humanitarian migration is a very pressing issue worldwide and globally, if we look at the amount of people arriving to countries like Estonia or Finland or Sweden or other countries here in the Baltics and Nordics, the discussion does really not reflect the actual groups of people that do arrive. And so I think the kind of public understanding of what migration is quite different from what it actually is. So very rarely we find media reports about people commuting between different countries and these kind of everyday mobilities, all these different forms of mobilities on basis of family ties, study, work, and all of that. And most of the time, it focuses on quite narrow perception. And immigration tends to be a topic, as we all know, that's kind of causes quite heated debates, and that is also reflected in the way it is debated in public. So very rarely do we find kind of calm, research-based understandings of what are the effects, what are the outcomes, what has happened, how has it developed over the past years, how does the EU what do EU policies have to do with this? But it's oftentimes very short-term. What is it now? What happens tomorrow? But not very, it's not discussed in the public as a policy issue that should be looked at from the long-term perspective, but very much in this kind of day-to-day decision-making where emotions kind of get high and are kind of polarized and the debates are quite polarized. And I think that's a shame. And I think that's why we need research-based information about these topics that should be brought to the public debate and then discussed so that we actually have facts about these issues and not just kind of populist kind of opinion making with claims that often do not are not really based in research.
Yes, I see that Raul, you would like to add something here.
Yes, in Estonia there's a public debate has changed quite drastically during the last few months as the government changed. And if you look back our previous government, what was relatively conservative, then migration issues were quite often discussed and actually some policy tools as to how to restrict student mobility was almost introduced in legislation. But then government changed, and today we discuss more the COVID, corona crisis related migration issues, and there's a very common topic is Finland, as Finland has been closed for Estonia, as our infection level was very, very high, and in other Baltic countries infection levels was very high. And many employees are trapped in Finland as they had to make hard choice whether to stay with family but lose income or to stay in employment in Finland, and they have to be away from the family. So I sincerely hope now the situation will start to slightly change, and would be very nice if Estonia and Finland can manage to create some kind of migration bubble as the Baltic countries did in last summer when the people the labor mobility was free between three Baltic countries, and that is considered as a success story.
Actually, what you pointed out about the public debate in Estonia, it's interestingly also similar to kind of European trends. So there's this this study where it looks at the kind of top list of concerns of European citizens, and immigration was on on the top of that list since 2014, and in 2015, and 58% of Europeans said that immigration was the most important issue facing the EU. But in 2019, it was only 34% who mentioned that issue, even though it still remained the number one concern. But then climate change had actually moved high, quite up as second place. And now, which you also just mentioned, and this is similar overall in Europe, that the agenda has shifted now in 2020, and that the focus is now on COVID-19, on job security, unemployment, but especially health and safety issues. So I can also agree to that now, much recently, this has been reflected also in Finland, that it has not been so strongly on the agenda, because of course this COVID situation has also changed. And also here we've had, the current government, and since the government has been acting, the public debate has also kind of calmed down a bit, I would say.
As you mentioned, Sara and Raul, also then trust and cooperation, mobility over borders is a natural part of the Nordic cooperation. And during the last maybe 2 or 3 decades, also mobility between Estonia and Finland has been a very natural part of economy and everyday life. So COVID has also influenced all that. But I would like to ask you if this COVID situation has maybe also brought along anything that could be called a positive influence on the mobility and migration. But if there would be any, then could you mention what comes to your mind, maybe Tiit and Raul?
I don't very much use this term positive and negative myself, to be honest. But coming to this studio, I also looked at the migration statistics as well, just out of curiosity. And of course, the effect on permanent migration is very similar to the commuting between the countries. And we see that both the number of people who have permanently left Estonia and those who have arrived decreased significantly in 2020 compared to 2021. So that's an interesting issue. And the question is, what is it, just a temporary? Would it a kind of surge after the crisis? That's quite an interesting topic to discuss.
Yes, but I think one thing what Madis was thinking about this question was that whether our something has really changed in our life. And if I think about this kind of Zoom and Teams meetings, which taking place today, or international conferences, which take place online, I think there are a few things which came to stay, in this sense that if you think about meetings with very short time notice, it's much easier to arrange these things, especially with an international audience today. You don't need to travel, you don't need to book hotels, don't need to fly. You can have a quick meeting, 2 hours, everybody's sitting in his or her office, and everything is fine. And I think this is something what really will be future as well. And from university side, for instance, we talk about defenses where we need to bring opponents from US or from Britain in order to come to the meeting and defense procedure. Today we can manage all these things via internet, and that really save time and save money for us.
And maybe that was very important thing that you brought out. And maybe just to enlarge what you discussed is that when you talk about migrant communities at large, then of course all these video tools were used before as well. But I think now for keeping contact with family members at home is much more easier. Also, that this kind of feeling at home and keeping the ties, and that brings us to the question that how does it itself maybe affect permanent migration? And at least what the theory tells us, that the more we keep the connections with homeland, the more likelihood is also, likely it is that people return at some point. So that could be an interesting question for the future, that would these kind of strong links that people are now able to keep, would they also lead to bigger return migration flows in the future?
So all of that might even have a positive effect on climate change, maybe, when people travel less and communicate over Zoom. Sara, yes?
Yeah, no, I think this is a really good point that, of course, these online ways of keeping in touch have been very common and very everyday tools for people who are separated from each other, either because they want to, and in many cases, because they have to live in different countries. And so I think for many transnational families, for example, like having like this online types of communication on a daily basis is something that they were already used to. And I think what this COVID then has, of course, brought about is that suddenly a larger share of the population suddenly was also forced to not move and to not go where they would regularly go. And then it started to also affect those groups who would normally be able to just, you know, commute between countries and visit their families, for example. And so I think it has been much, the use has been much, much broader. But then, of course, the climate change aspect is a very central one, that people don't travel around, and what we just mentioned about work life. But then also I think one thing we here at the Migration Institute, we don't only look at cross-border mobility, but also mobility within countries. So how do people move between different cities? And there also one can say that this, what this corona has of course done is because people do not have to live, or they have realized that they maybe don't have to live in the same city where they work, so that people can actually move to the countryside or to other places and spend time, more time, if not permanently, but then more time at, for example, holiday homes and work from there. So I think this also has an effect of where do people work, not only in terms of cross-border mobility, but also within countries.
Thank you very much, Sara, Tiit, and Raul, for participating in this Nordic Talks program at Äripäev. And just to round up, I would like to ask you to give just very short remarks or thoughts about the future possible development of migration, maybe in the perspective of coming 1 or 2 years. How might migration and mobility be developing in the near future in our Nordic-Baltic region?
Certainly, I think the one big trend is that there are more and different types of moves, and this share of permanent migration probably will reduce, and then the complexity of different types of moves, it grows again. And when it comes to climate change, I'm even not quite sure what's better and what's worse, because I understand that all these digital tools, they have huge climate impact as well.
Raul?
I don't think if you look 1 or 2 years, that there will be very big changes. I think next 1-2 years, we have to live with COVID-19, and all these restrictions are going and coming back again and again, as we don't know how many waves are still waiting us. But in the longer term, I think if we look at migration patterns in Estonia and Baltic countries at the moment, we mostly see people coming from the former Soviet Union to Estonia, Ukrainians, Russians. But the share of the third country nations most probably will start to increase as our living standards and the income level will increase. So perhaps after 10 years, we are not anymore the gateway for Scandinavia, but these people will stay in Estonia.
And Sara?
Yes, actually also for Finland, the biggest countries where people come from for work right now are Ukraine, Russia, and actually China. So this is actually interesting, also kind of similar trend there. And yeah, I very much agree with the fact that I think in the coming 1-2 years, the effect of the current pandemic will still be seen. And of course, one thing we haven't really mentioned here is that I just find important to state is that what is really crucial, I mean, if we look not only at the Nordic-Baltic countries, but worldwide, is, for example, how much access do different groups of people have to vaccines? I think that's a question that right now is, for example, very central for the upcoming years. And are all groups of people able to get these vaccines? And those who are, for example, so those who are in refugee camps or who might be in the country irregularly, all of that. So we have different groups of people who are more vulnerable than others. And when we look from the health perspective, this is a question that we need to take seriously, that immigrants are often disproportionately affected by, for example, this pandemic. But yeah, in the longer run, I think the kind of full understanding is that what we also was pointed out already, that people do not move from one country to another and then they stay there forever, but that we look at mobility more broadly and how people move both within the EU and then from other countries, and that this kind of this flexibility that we now pointed out, that this, for example, technology makes possible, that this is probably also reflected in how people move and settle, and that I hope then that also policies and legislation adapt to that and make it possible for people to live like that.
Yes, thank you, Sara. And the final comment comes from Raul.
Though that was more like a technical issue, I wanted to add that if we look next 1-2 years, then instead of one passport, an IT card, we need to have two passports. One is ordinary passport, the other one is a vaccination passport. And those who don't have this vaccination passport, they will have a problem. And therefore, we will see actual discrimination in these traveling procedures.
Yes. Well, with that remark, we are concluding our today's conversation on migration and mobility. And you were listening to the Nordic Talks program, prepared in collaboration between the Nordic Council of Ministers and Aribab, and participants from the University of Tartu and Migration Institute of Finland. Thank you and have a nice day.
Nordic Sustainable Economy Podcast Series, delivered by Nordic Council of Ministers.